I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's August 30th, and we have a lot to talk about. Today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Roberto Alfonso Dunn from the Tisch Multiple Sclerosis Research Center about some interesting and potentially encouraging results from a recent study that he headed up. And then later in today's episode, we'll switch gears and talk with Trevor Hardy. Trevor's an attorney who lives with MS, and he also lives with his service dog, Tristan. Trevor is going to share all the ways that Tristan has been a complete life changer for him, and he'll share some of the things you might want to think about if you're considering bringing a service dog into your life. But before we get to my conversations with Dr. Roberto Alfonso Dunn and Trevor Hardy, there are a few other things that you should know about. By now, we've all seen or heard news about the outbreak of monkeypox in the United States and elsewhere in the world. And I know some of you are wondering whether having MS makes you any more susceptible to monkeypox, or whether the monkeypox vaccines are appropriate for someone who's living with MS. Well, the National MS Society has published some information about monkeypox and MS, and I thought it would be a good idea to review some of that information. The monkeypox virus is part of the same family of viruses that cause smallpox. Monkeypox symptoms include fever, headache, muscle aches, respiratory symptoms like cough, sore throat, and nasal congestion, and a rash that can look like pimples or blisters. The strain of monkeypox identified in the United States is rarely fatal. And if you're living with MS, here's what you need to know about monkeypox. Having MS does not increase your risk for getting monkeypox. And having MS does not make monkeypox worse if you do get it. And people with MS who are at high risk of getting monkeypox or have been exposed to monkeypox should discuss getting vaccinated with their neurologist or MS specialist. So let's talk about vaccines for a minute. The CDC recommends two different vaccines to prevent monkeypox for people considered at high risk, and we'll talk about who those high-risk people are in just another moment. These two approved and already available monkeypox vaccines can also be used after exposure to monkeypox to prevent or reduce the severity of monkeypox symptoms. One of the two recommended monkeypox vaccines is a live viral vaccine, and the other is a live attenuated viral vaccine. Live and live attenuated viral vaccines are generally not recommended for people who are living with MS. But for some people with MS at high risk of getting monkeypox, the risks of monkeypox itself may outweigh any potential risks from the vaccines. So I'll repeat this part of the MS Society's guidance. People with MS who are at high risk of getting monkeypox or have been exposed to monkeypox should discuss getting vaccinated with their neurologist or MS specialist. Now, finally, I want to share the CDC's information for who is at high risk of getting monkeypox. That group includes people who have been identified by public health officials as a contact of someone with monkeypox, people who are aware that one of their sexual partners in the past 2 weeks has been diagnosed with monkeypox, people who have had multiple sexual partners in the past 2 weeks in an area with known cases of monkeypox, and people whose jobs may expose them to orthopox viruses, including laboratory workers who perform testing for orthopox viruses, laboratory workers who handle cultures or animals with orthopox viruses, and some designated healthcare or public health workers. Now, I think every one of us should always put our health and safety first. Having said that, I'll also add that had we not just spent more than 2 years face-to-face with the often deadly consequences of COVID-19, monkeypox would probably not be receiving the amount of public interest and attention that it's been getting. But I completely understand. given what we've been through, it's hard not to see how any viral outbreak could trigger some very real fear and even PTSD. It's important to remember that unlike what we've experienced with COVID-19, the strain of monkeypox we're seeing is most often not fatal. The vaccine already exists, it isn't new, and although monkeypox symptoms are annoying and those blisters aren't very attractive, this isn't the next wave that's going to threaten humanity. So please be safe, heed the public health warnings, read the guidance from the National MS Society, talk with your doctor if you feel you've been exposed or you're at high risk, and carry on. If you'd like to review the National MS Society's information and guidance about monkeypox and MS, or the CDC's information and guidance about monkeypox vaccines, you'll find those links in today's show notes. Results of a Phase 3 clinical trial for ublituximab show that, when compared to Aubagio, this investigational anti-CD20 or B-cell depleting disease-modifying therapy was more effective at reducing MS relapses and preventing new lesions in the brain over a period of 96 weeks among people who were living with relapsing remitting MS. The drug's manufacturer, TG Therapeutics, conducted two identical Phase 3 trials, enrolling 549 people in one trial and 545 people in the other identical trial. Both trials showed ublituximab to be twice as effective as Aubagio in preventing MS relapses. In one of the two trials, no evidence of disease activity was observed in 44.6% of the participants given ublituximab, compared to 15% of the participants given Aubagio. And in the other trial, no evidence of disease activity was observed in 43% of the participants given ublituximab, compared to 11.4% of the participants given Aubagio. Infusion-related reactions occurred in almost half of the participants being given ublituximab. Now, some of you may be saying to yourselves, aren't there already approved anti-CD20 therapies available to people living with MS? And the answer is yes. So why should there be one more? Well, I think we all know that different people respond to MS medications differently. Perhaps this could be a therapy that some people respond to best. And the other difference between ublituximab and other anti-CD20 therapies is time. Ocrevus is an anti-CD20 therapy, and like Ocrevus, ublituximab is given every 6 months by infusion. The difference is that an Ocrevus infusion takes 2 or 3 hours, while a ublituximab infusion takes just 1 hour. So ublituximab may be a therapy that fits better into someone's busy life. I also want to point out that Kesimpta is a B-cell depleting monoclonal antibody, and Kesimpta is administered once a month at home using an auto-injector. So these similar disease-modifying therapies offer varying levels of convenience. The FDA is reviewing the clinical trial data from TG Therapeutics, and we should expect their ruling toward the end of this year. If you'd like to review the Phase 3 clinical trial data for ublituximab, you'll find a link in today's show notes. One of the things that we've learned about anti-CD20 disease-modifying therapies is that by depleting B cells in the immune system, they make it more difficult for someone to manufacture antibodies after receiving one of the approved COVID-19 vaccines. This has left some people living with MS feeling as though they don't have any real options when it comes to protecting themselves against COVID-19 while they're on one of these anti-CD20 DMTs. But recently published results from a study at the Tisch Multiple Sclerosis Research Center may offer some potential encouragement. I had an opportunity to chat with the lead author of this study, and in a moment, we'll hear my conversation with Dr. Roberto Alfonso Dunn. One of the more interesting and more challenging and more frightening aspects of the COVID-19 pandemic is that our experts have been forced to learn about this virus in real time. If there weren't any books or papers or presentations about COVID-19 floating out there until the virus was upon us. But science has been catching up, and researchers continue to learn more about how to best fight back against COVID-19 and all of its variants. While we've seen approved COVID-19 vaccines save hundreds of thousands of lives just in the United States alone, we've also heard that people living with MS who are on anti-CD20 therapies like rituximab or Ocrevus weren't mounting an adequate immune response to these vaccines, leaving people with already compromised health with one more thing to worry about. But as I said, science has been catching up, and we're continuing to learn. A research team from the Tisch Multiple Sclerosis Research Center in New York has just published the results of a study that I think offers potentially encouraging news for people with MS who are on these anti-CD20 therapies. Dr. Roberto Alfonso Dunn is the lead author of this paper, and he's joining me today to share what he and his team have learned. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Dunn.
Thanks for having me.
The idea that people on anti-CD20 therapies failed to mount an adequate immune response to the COVID-19 vaccines was based upon their B-cell response. But our immune system is made up of more than just B-cells. Do I have that much right?
Yes, you do. So the adaptive immune system has two branches. One is called the humoral one, and it has the B cells producing the antibodies. And then you have the cellular adaptive immune system that includes the T cells.
So tell me a little bit about the study that you and your team were involved in. What was the study looking at? Sure. How many participants were involved? What can you tell me?
Sure. So we look at the patients, multiple sclerosis patients receiving anti-CD20. We consider 43 individuals. We collected the samples here at the center through the 1 year from starting early spring last year to early spring this year. And we look at B-cell response, looking at antibody levels, and also at their neutralizing capacity. And on top of that, we wanted also to look at the T-cell response. And for that, we do an in vivo stimulation of blood cells with the viral spike.
So tell me, when you looked at the T cell response, what did you learn?
So when we look at the T cell response, we saw, well, first of all, in terms of antibody levels, we only saw like a 23.8% of seroconversion. That means production of antibodies against the virus. But when we look at the T cell response, we saw that for some of these patients, they had a response that it was equal to the one that we saw for the healthy controls that we use in this study as a reference. And for other people, we saw that that they had even a higher T-cell response compared to healthy controls. And we thought that was of interest.
I would say that would be of great interest. So just to repeat what I heard again, and I describe as pretty encouraging outcome here. The people in the study with MS had a T cell response, immune response that was equal to the healthy controls in the study who did not have MS, and some of the people in the study had a response that was greater than even what the healthy controls had. Is that, am I getting that right?
Yeah. So as a group in total, it was higher. The mean values were higher. But yeah, you are totally correct with that statement.
So what's the implication here for someone living with MS or I should say the potential implication for someone living with MS who's on an anti-CD20 therapy?
So the implication is that they're having problems developing antibodies, but they still have this second branch of the adaptive immune system that seems to be working. So it's hard to tell how that correlates to protection, because one of the reasons is that immunology has focused mostly in the importance of antibodies in immune response protection, and not so much in T cell response. But these results are encouraging in the sense that it seems that these individuals, they still have that branch functional, the T cell response branch, and that might offer some level of protections against the infection of the virus.
I'm curious, are you planning next steps given what you've learned?
So as I say, we were collecting for a whole year. So we have collected like longitudinal time points. So we are interested into seeing several aspects of vaccine performance. We're interested in seeing what's the effect of boosters, you know? Multiple vaccine doses in these individuals, whether that increases the likelihood of developing antibodies, and also whether it increases the T cell response. That's something that we're currently doing, and hopefully we will have some results for that later on this year.
Well, Dr. Roberto Alfonso Dunn, thank you for adding to our growing body of knowledge about COVID-19. And for sharing this outcome of your work that may offer some potential encouragement for a lot of people living with MS who are on anti-CD20 therapies. I hope you'll come back and talk to me again as you reach the next stage of your research.
Sure, Tina. I hope so too.
We know that MS impacts individuals differently. And because of the potentially wide variance in MS symptoms and progression, a lot of people living with MS are left wondering and worrying about the future trajectory of their particular disease course. And speculating about the future can be emotionally draining and mentally distracting for anyone. But what if there were clues at the time of diagnosis that could serve as accurate predictors of your future quality of life? A research team decided to explore this question, and the results of their study were just recently published. The study focused on almost 5,000 participants who had enrolled in the North American Research Committee on Multiple Sclerosis Registry within 3 years of being diagnosed with MS. All of the study participants lived in the United States, and 81% of the study participants were women. The study participants were assessed 3 times during the study, and they each completed an average of 12 health-related quality of life questionnaires over a period of time that ranged from 1 to 27 years after diagnosis. The research team used a novel method of statistical analysis, something called group-based trajectory modeling, to identify groups of individuals who had similar patterns of physical and mental health-related quality of life trajectories in the decades that followed their diagnosis. In other words, did people who were experiencing a similar physical or mental health-related quality of life after diagnosis share any defining characteristics at the time of their diagnosis? Well, the researchers were able to identify 5 different physical health-related quality of life trajectories. 26.4% of the study participants reported consistently low and stable physical health-related quality of life. 29.2% of the study participants reported moderately low and stable physical health-related quality of life. 13.4% reported moderate to low physical health-related quality of life during the first 10 years following their diagnosis, but that was followed by normal health-related quality of life after those initial 10 years. 17.1% of the study participants reported experiencing an early decline in physical health-related quality of life within the first 8 years of their diagnosis, and then reported an increase to a moderate or normal physical health-related quality of life after those first 8 years. And 13.9% reported persistently normal physical health-related quality of life for 20 years following their diagnosis, followed by a decline in their physical health-related quality of life. Older age at the time of diagnosis and worse physical disability and fatigue were the factors associated with increased odds of reporting the lowest physical health-related quality of life compared with all the other possible disease trajectories. For those study participants reporting the lowest physical health-related quality of life, the average age at the time of diagnosis was 46, compared to an average age of 38 among those study participants who reported the highest physical health-related quality of life. Members of the group with the lowest physical health-related quality of life had moderate to severe fatigue and moderate disability, including mobility issues that required a cane, early in their disease course. As we might expect, members of the group who reported the highest physical health-related quality of life experienced minimal fatigue and normal physical functioning or only very mild disability. And when the research team looked at mental health-related quality of life, they were able to identify four distinct trajectories. 18.6% of the study participants had long-term low mental health-related quality of life. 32.9% reported moderately low and stable mental health-related quality of life. 22.2% of the study participants had moderately low mental health-related quality of life within the first 10 years of diagnosis, followed by normal mental health-related quality of life after those first 10 years. And 26.4% of the study participants reported long-term normal mental health-related quality of life. Study participants with an annual income of $50,000 or less and no college education at the time of their MS diagnosis reported the lowest mental health-related quality of life. And while older age at the time of diagnosis was predictive of worse physical health-related quality of life, it turned out to be predictive of better mental health-related quality of life. So what sorts of insights does this study provide? Well, it identifies a few characteristics like age, income, and level of education that may be predictive of someone's future physical or mental health-related quality of life. And at first blush, you might think that those specific characteristics are sort of non-negotiable. There isn't much you can do about your age or your income level or your level of education on the day that you're diagnosed. However, if you can foresee a more challenging trajectory in your future quality of life, you can take steps to build your future support network. You can build your social network. And you can participate in the kinds of activities like physical exercise, cognitive behavioral therapy, or mindfulness meditation that have all been shown to deliver positive improvements in quality of life among people living with MS. In other words, you can take proactive steps to stack the deck now so that you can beat the odds later. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. And speaking of things that can impact your quality of life, it feels like the perfect time to meet my guest, Trevor Hardy. Trevor is an attorney who's living with MS in Cleveland, Ohio, and I'd be lying if I didn't tell you how much I loved hearing how Trevor's service dog, Tristan, has opened so many doors for Trevor. In a moment, we'll meet my guest, Trevor Hardy. Trevor Hardy is an employment law attorney with the law firm of Littler Mendelson in Cleveland, Ohio. Trevor's also a member of the National MS Society's Activism Advisory Committee. That's a committee that advises the society on how to use public policy to improve the lives of people affected by MS. And he's a district activist leader in Ohio's 11th Congressional District. Trevor lives with MS, and recently he's been teamed up with his service dog, Tristan. Today we'll talk about the impact that Tristan has had on Trevor's life, and we'll answer some common questions you may have about how service animals can support people living with MS. Welcome to the podcast, Trevor.
Thanks for having me, John.
Before we get into your life with Tristan, when were you diagnosed with MS, and what were the circumstances that led to that diagnosis?
So I was diagnosed in 2018. I had a series of symptoms that popped up. So I suffered from optic neuritis. I had difficulty walking. I was falling, experiencing physical sensations that were abnormal. And from there, I was connected with a neurologist who ended up diagnosing me with MS after going through MRIs and a spinal tap.
We know that MS impacts each person differently. Can you share some of the challenges you faced as a result of MS?
Absolutely. So I walk with a cane. I use that to get around, and sometimes I need a wheelchair, just depending on, you know, fatigue issues and difficulty walking. I do have some residual peripheral vision loss in my right eye from the optic neuritis, and I deal with chronic pain as well. So I think a lot of people out there will understand when I say the bee sting sensation or the electrical sensation. That's a pretty common and perpetual thing for me.
A service dog can be of enormous assistance in helping people with MS maintain their stability, their mobility, and therefore their independence. So tell us about Tristan. Has he helped you avoid falling?
Immensely. So before I got Tristan, I was falling 2 to 3 times a week. Was pretty common for me. After I got Tristan on February 11th of 2022, I have not fallen once. So Tristan helps me by picking up items that I drop. So he helps me maintain my balance because I'm not bending over to try and pick up and retrieve items. And he's trained to pick up those items, sit down, and hand them to me, which has really just saved me from countless falls.
What other ways does Tristan assist you in everyday activities?
So he's phenomenal. He can push plates. So those little disability access buttons for doors. He can drag my laundry basket whenever it's full of laundry and take it to a different room or a different location within a room. He is able to turn lights on and off. He's able to open and close drawers, doors, and cabinets. He really can perform so many different things. I think one of the coolest things he does is he can help me with transactions. So if I'm having a particularly difficult time with fatigue, he can take a credit card, hand it over to a sales associate, and then take the bag of items that I purchased back and carry that for me.
Really? Wow. Maybe if you help him learn the intricacies of using a mouse, he can do the online shopping as well.
Yeah, that wouldn't be bad. I do enough of that damage on my own, so I'm not sure he needs to help me there.
While the physical benefits you mentioned are the most obvious and immediate ways for a service animal to assist someone with disabilities, what kinds of social or emotional benefits have you experienced since you've been partnered with Tristan?
Yeah, so Tristan's really given me back my independence, and he's given me a different way to interact with the community and go into spaces that might not have felt as accessible before. And I know that Tristan also acts as a bridge between me and the community. So whereas individuals may have previously just seen a 34-year-old man walking with a cane, now they see the service dog who's assisting and performing tasks and helping me navigate the world with MS. And it creates a new social interaction that may not have happened before and allows me to educate people, not just about service dogs, but about MS too. And emotionally, he's always there. He goes to work with me. He goes to the grocery store with me, to dinner with me. He really does everything. So having that constant companionship really gives me a boost of confidence whenever I'm in difficult situations.
Listening to all the ways that a service dog can improve your quality of life, I'm sure some of our listeners are wondering how to go about getting one. So how and where does someone go to begin this process? And I'm wondering whether someone can train their own dog to be a service dog.
So there are some individuals who train their own dogs to be service dogs. and they are able to go through different training programs or figure out the best way to mold a dog into the service dog that they need. I actually took an alternate path. So I used an organization called Canine Companions. They're based out in California, and they provide service dogs to individuals with disabilities all across the country. And I know they place several hundred dogs a year. And for me, that was the best way to go about it, because I have a built-in support system of people who are following up with me, making sure that Tristan is doing well, making sure that he's getting the veterinary care that he needs, and making sure that our partnership and our team is really working the best way that it can going forward.
Listening to how or where Tristan accompanies you and how he helps you, it occurs to me that people really need their service animal to be with them in a variety of different places that we find ourselves in every day, like restaurants and like stores, maybe schools, hotels, and even on the job. What's been your experience when you're out and about with Tristan? Are businesses accepting when you and Tristan walk in?
Yeah, I would say that most are. I've had really positive experiences at most of the places that I take him. We've only been denied access to one place since I got him. Some places will ask, is that a service dog? And I'll explain that he is and will be granted admission into the place. But I think most places look at it as an opportunity, look at it as an opportunity to talk, to learn more about the dog. And I know whenever I go out to restaurants, it's not uncommon for them to ask him if he needs a drink before they ask me my drink order. So a lot of places really are welcoming and accepting.
The Americans with Disabilities Act, otherwise known as the ADA, has just celebrated its 32nd anniversary. It protects the fundamental rights of people with disabilities. I'm curious, does it also protect Tristan's fundamental rights? I'm curious about what questions businesses are permitted or maybe not permitted to ask you, and how you and Tristan best navigate those situations.
Yeah, so Tristan is allowed to go to places of public accommodation with me. And we've talked about some of those places. So think of restaurants and stores. They don't necessarily include places like houses of worship or private establishments. Think of a wedding hall that may not be open to the public. But if you are talking about a place of public accommodation, so a place that regularly allows members of the public to come in, think of a mall. If we were to go in and a store would ask questions, so they're pretty limited on what they can ask. And the two big ones are, is the dog a service animal required because of a disability? And what work or task has the dog been trained to perform? And it's important to know that you don't have to show the dog performing the task. You don't have to explain which disability you have or what condition you have. It's just those questions. And if you answer them and keep the dog under control while you're in the establishment, then you should be able to have access and stay in that place.
We've been talking about service dogs like Tristan. We also know of people who have emotional support animals, therapy pets, comfort or companion pets. Are they considered service animals and covered under the ADA in terms of where they're allowed to go in public places?
So generally not. I think one of the biggest distinctions I like to make for people is that Tristan is not a pet. So Tristan is professionally trained to help mitigate my MS and the limitations that I have as a result of my MS. So oftentimes therapy dogs and companion animals, while they can comfort an individual, they're not trained to perform a specific disability-related task. So there is a distinction and a separation there. So even though you may see therapy animals in a hospital, they're performing a different function than Tristan or a similar service dog would be.
Now, what about someone who may not be a homeowner? For instance, if someone is renting an apartment and their lease prohibits dogs, can they request an exception for a service dog?
Yeah, so that's generally something that can be done. You want to make sure that you look at the Fair Housing Act and then any local laws and regulations that might apply. But generally, if you're renting, your landlord should permit you as a reasonable accommodation to have a service dog with you, as long as that service dog is trained to perform a task for you and is specifically there to help mitigate your disability. Keep in mind that it's your responsibility as the handler and the one overseeing the service dog to make sure that the dog doesn't destroy the apartment, doesn't disrespect the yard or the place. And that's a really important part of being a good renter or being a good steward of the resources.
We've been talking about some of the ways a service dog can help someone living with MS, but service dogs need care themselves. What are some of the things that you had to take into consideration before getting Tristan, and what advice might you have for others before they decide to add a service animal to their life?
Yeah, so I had to think and make sure that I would have the time necessary to devote to Tristan. So whether that is just time spent making sure that he's fed and that he's exercised. And then I also had to make sure that I had the financial resources available to provide vet care, to provide food, to provide activities, toys, different things that he might need as he progresses and our teamwork progresses. I think that any individual who is considering a service dog needs to take stock of their life and their lifestyle, you know, what their limitations may be, how a service dog fits in and helps mitigate those limitations, but also keeps in mind that a service dog does need things and does require things like exercise. And I think it's important to point out that service dogs can get exercise by playing fetch. So if you are immobile and unable to walk the dog, you know, sometimes that's okay if you're able to provide that stimulation. Service dogs can also be trained to accompany individuals in wheelchairs. So you're able to make sure that the dog gets its walk by, you know, taking it in your wheelchair. That could also be acceptable.
Well, Trevor Hardy, thank you for all you do as an MS activist to improve the lives of people affected by MS. Thanks for talking with me today. And please, give my best to Tristan.
Will do.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/261. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.